Haven't started yet, and we're already crying. I'm Judy Pearson. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And I want to thank, truly, from the bottom of my heart, those who are responsible for getting me here. This is very, very special to me. Because, you see, it was at this roundup I heard my story. I was 6.5 years sober, and it was at this roundup I heard my story. And never did I, at 6.5 years, think I would be standing behind this podium. Never did I think that was going to happen. Now, and this is very, very special to me. It's a bittersweet thing that we're not going to be here next year. Because this place, and a lot of you remember, of course, when it was the Radisson, and there's a lot of memories here for a lot of us. And this was the first big conference I had been to, and I can remember feeling that freedom, you know, that finally being in a room full of alcoholics, and finally I was not alone. You know, I finally realized there were other alcoholics and people who knew what I was feeling and who knew what I was experiencing. And I was just amazed because, you know, I was like so many of us. I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one when I got here. So I thank you. I thank all of you for asking me and allowing me to be here. And I'm going to do my job, and I do feel like this is my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that everybody has a niche in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And there, all of those jobs are important. You know, the guy that makes the coffee at your group is just as important as a speaker at a meeting. If you don't think so, show up at a meeting where no coffee's made. My God, it's the end of the world. I want to tell you all, too, that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not a teacher. I am not a messiah. Okay, I don't have all the answers. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go through the same pains and the same questions and the same things that all of you go through. There is nothing special about being up here. Okay, God gave me a gift in that I have an ability to talk in front of a bunch of people. That's it. Okay, that is it. And it is a gift from God. It is nothing that makes me superior at all. So I don't, well, I guess I'm telling you that because, you know, a lot of times, I just don't want to be put up on a pedestal, man. I can't measure up. I just cannot measure up, and I don't even want to try. So know that when I share things with you, that it really is coming from the heart, and it really is things that I have experienced, because I believe that. You see, I believe that's the greatest gift we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the ability to share our experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic. I believe it is far better therapy for the alcoholic than any others known, than any others out there, is one drunk sharing with another. Because I know when I look into your eyes and I see your heart through your eyes, that you do know what I'm feeling. And when I hear you share your pain, I can look at you and say, yes, baby, I know what you're feeling. I know what you're feeling, and I mean it, you know. And it's good, and it's clean, and it's honest, and it's pure. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I love this program. I do not get nervous when I have to speak behind a podium. I don't get nervous. I get real excited because I get excited about what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me in my life. No, and it is a wonderful, wonderful program. I also have some opinions. Now, I know that the program says that AA... Y'all really didn't think I was going to slide on that, did you? AA has no opinion on outside issues, however, I have. I also have some opinions on inside issues, and I'll probably share those, too. I typically ask God not to let me get too hard into that, but he doesn't listen, and eventually I always end up sharing something, and sometimes I step on people's toes, but that's good. You know, we need that. Keeps you thinking, keeps you, you know, awake, keeps you moving. Controversy's good. We have to have those people in Alcoholics Anonymous that sit back and let it happen, and then we have to have those like myself who says, no, you don't do it this way, you know, and we need that mix, and I mean that seriously. We need that balance where there are those who say, it's okay, it's all going to work out, and then there's those like myself, no, it isn't, not unless we do, and that balance is what keeps us alive, you know, that's what keeps us alive. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And that's my job up here. And I'm going to, if you've heard my talk before, it doesn't change. I am not one of those speakers who can give you a different talk every time I get up. It just doesn't happen for me. I know there's a lot of them that can do that, and I envy them, and I wish I could, but I just can't do it. And now my talk is the same as if you heard me 10 years ago, with the exception of the past 10 years. It's going to be the same. Now, and I do that for a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason is because I know when I heard my story, what a relief it was to me. And so when I tell my story, I want to make sure that there's one person out there that can identify, and one person out there that can understand where I came from. And I came from a Polish Catholic home, and that pretty well sums it up, doesn't it? I could quit right there. I don't have to explain anything else. My mother divorced when I was very young, 5 or 6 years old. And she remarried about a year later, and she brought into our lives an alcoholic in the early stages of alcoholism. And I must tell you that I loved that man. I was so glad that he was in our lives, and he was a wonderful man, and he was like all of us are in our early stages of alcoholism. He was outgoing, and he was friendly, and he was loving, and he was caring, and he was sensitive. And as the disease took hold, that changed. And it was a Jekyll Hyde situation. And I was one of those kids that were raised in an alcoholic home that once we get here and we clean up our stories, we don't want to talk about anymore. You know, but my alcoholic home was one of those where people got beat up a lot. You know, as a child, I got slammed up against the wall because I said the wrong thing at the wrong time. And the problem was there was never the right thing or the right time to say it. You know, there just wasn't. You just never knew what was going to happen when he was in full-blown alcoholism. You know, I had a mouth on me even then, and when I hit my teen years, there were a lot of times I'd wake up in the morning, I'd have a cut lip. I had more black eyes than any human being should have in a lifetime, let alone in their teen years. I was physically and verbally and sexually abused, and that's just part of my story, and that's part of where the alcoholism went in our home. No, so I didn't have a good childhood, and there's no way to make that any nicer. You know, what I've done and what I've been able to do in sobriety is to look for the good points, look for the few good times that we had as a family, but there weren't any good times as a family. And I don't tell you that because I want you to feel sorry for me or that I need your sympathy or anything along that line. I tell you that because if you're sitting out there and you are going to be the perpetual victim, I'm going to take that away from you. Okay? And that should not be your excuse for staying drunk. All right, I'm also a big believer in that a slip is not necessary. Okay, you can come into Alcoholics Anonymous and stay sober from the very first meeting, because I did, and that's my experience. It is not a prerequisite of Alcoholics Anonymous membership to go out 15 or 20 times and drink again. All right? Yeah, go ahead, man. I mean, you know. And I really have very, very little patience with it after about the third time. I really do. You know, because I have seen it, and I know you've seen it. I've seen it where people use it as a ploy for sympathy. I don't feel sorry for you, man. You knew what that drink was going to do to you. Why are you acting like this is news to you? You know? I went out one more time, and you know I got drunk. Well, duh. Just a couple of beers. I didn't think I'd get drunk again. No, people. See, here's what's sad about that, is that you keep playing games with that, and one day you won't be able to come back. You know, you'll either lose your mind or you'll lose your life. It's not a game. And we absolutely have to remember it is not a game. You know, I am not impressed with the fact that you went out 56 times. You're alcoholic. You're not stupid. Okay? Get sober. They used to tell us, stay sober long enough to get sober. And that first year of sobriety, honey, there were a lot of white-knuckle days. There were a lot. I was not one of those that came in the doors of AA and never wanted to drink again. I wanted to drink again. I didn't, but I wanted to. Anyhow, so I'm in this household, and I picked up my first drink at the age of 10, and I liked it, you know. I really did. There was nothing about it. I didn't have to teach myself how to drink. I loved the effects of alcohol. Yeah, I loved the taste of alcohol. I loved everything about it. I loved the way it smelled. I loved everything about it. By the time I was 14, I was an alcoholic as I know alcoholism today. And I absolutely believe that, you know. Because of the violence in my home, I was learning how to react violently. And that was about this stage, about 14. I remember my stepfather hit me, and I bounced up against the wall and with such a force that it just kind of slid down. And I got up and kind of shook myself back into sanity. And doubled up my fist and plowed him, got him right on the jaw, man. And I'm going to tell you, to this day, that still feels good, you know? Yeah, I just thought, you know, this is it, man. And I became just as addicted to fighting as I did drinking. just as addicted. That was a whole thing I had to recover from, too, was the violence that I had been raised with and that I knew. Because I was not one of those gals who drank in her kitchen alone at home, all right? I was one of those women who went out in bars, can you believe it, and fought and drank. I was one of those women who, God forbid, actually picked up men when I went out to drink. For shame, for shame. I don't mind sharing that. You know, there's some folks in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're sober 2 years and they're virgins again. I know you've met them. And it's like my friend Mel says, what's up with that? I don't get it. I wasn't one of them, I can tell you that. And the, you know, as I left home and I got out on my own and I did all my drinking, really. The worst of my drinking I drank was before I was of legal age to drink, actually. And I would go into these bars and I'd pick up these guys and I'd bring them home and they'd be there maybe, you know, overnight. Maybe they'd stay a couple nights. Maybe they'd just be there 15 minutes, you know how that goes. And it was just horrible. It was, you know, and you know this if you're an alcoholic. You go out and you do those kind of things and you live that kind of life and you wake up maybe in the morning or in the middle of the night and you say, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. You know better. You know better. But then the memories start chasing you, you know, and the little bits and pieces start coming back of what you did and what you said and who you hurt. And you got to drink, man, because there's no other way. There's just no other way. And I can remember waking up like that. I can remember those mornings of waking up and saying, you know, I got to change. But now I'm 19, 20 years old, and I can't even sign my name because I got the morning shakes so bad. You know, so I'm having to take a couple drinks to calm down. No. And so you got to do what you got to do because you got to survive. You got to survive. I was going through a stage where I was falling in love a lot. I was getting engaged a lot. I got engaged 3 times there for over about a period, year and a half. Of course, it wasn't very difficult because I was engaged to 2 guys at once. That keeps it kind of... That's not a pleasant situation. I got, you know, I used to get confused a lot when I drank, and I got confused this one particular evening, and I had invited them both over for dinner. And they arrived about 3 minutes between one another, and I just went out the back door and figured I'll let them settle this. I went in the kitchen with some lame excuse like I'm going to go stir the pasta, and I split, man. I was out of there. Because that used to happen a lot, you know. I would get in these, what I used to call relationships, but they never lasted. And what the truth of the matter was is I'd have a man come into my life. I'd have him help me pay my bills and get caught up. And it's like I said earlier, you know, alcoholic, I may be stupid, I wasn't. And I'd let them pay my bills and I'd let them get everything caught up for me. And eventually these guys would say to me, you've got to do something about your drinking. It's either me or the booze. And I'd say, bye. Because nobody is going to take away my drinking. You are not going to take away the only thing that makes my life bearable. You're not going to do it. I mean, we come as a team, man, or we don't come. That's just the way it is. And they would walk out of my life. I was not going to have anybody taking that away from me. Nobody. My relationships with my family had long since gone down the tubes. You know, I had no communication with my sisters. I had poor communication with my mother. I lied to her constantly. She was constantly bailing me out of some kind of trouble somehow. Always something. You know, I was just a thorn in everybody's side. By the time I was 21, I really had no friends. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said you have to get new playgrounds and new playmates. I had no more playmates. Nobody wanted to be around me, you know. I remember going at a bar one night, and I was sitting there drinking, and I was sitting at the bar, and they had the mirror back there behind, you know how so many of them do. And I was sitting there watching myself get drunk, and there were 2 guys coming behind me, and one guy was going to make a pass at me, and his friend grabbed him aside and said, don't touch her. That woman's crazy. You don't want to get mixed up with that one. And he was right, because I just as soon pull a knife on you as look at you. You know, I was so violent, I was so sick, and it was all a defense mechanism, you all know that. You see, if you act that way and you behave that way, people stay away from you. They stay away, and that's what I wanted. For years, all I wanted was just people leave me alone and let me drink in peace. You know, just let me drink in peace. And they won't do that. They just won't do that. Somebody's got to be your friend. They got to come up. They got to talk to you. Now, Jude, you need to do something about your drinking. Then you got to backhand them because they won't leave you alone. And it starts all over. It's the same thing all over again. Just let me drink in peace. And then I had now started to drink at home because it, you see, I got frightened of myself. I did not know what I was going to do. I know that there had been incidences where, one in particular, where it took my mother and my two sisters to pull me off my stepfather. I was choking the life out of that man. I had my hands around his throat and he was turning blue. And all I could see and all I heard in my mind was, die, damn you, die. And I could see him turning blue and I wanted him dead so badly. And all I remember is my sister screaming, Judy, Judy. And then my mother grabbed a hold of my shoulders and said, my God, girl, you're killing him. And it was like cold water in my face. And I got up off of him and just walked off like I had no more than swatted a fly. And now I just didn't care. I just didn't care. And that's another line we tell ourselves as alcoholics. I really don't care. I really don't care. And we really do care. But we have to tell ourselves that. We have to tell ourselves we don't care. You know, because we can't cope with the fact. We can't cope with it if we did. I've already started going to see psychiatrists and whatnot. Went to 8th Floor Grady. You ever been there? You don't want to go. And went and saw a shrink there for a period of time, and he told me it was all my stepfather's fault, and I, of course, agreed with him. It wasn't, again, now, I wasn't going because of my drinking. I was going because of my violent behavior. And I was going because somebody who had cared about me had said, Judy, maybe you need to go see someone for a little while. Maybe they can help you. One of the guys I was engaged to had suggested that. And I did, really, because I thought maybe there might be some worth there, and I thought it might do some good. And it did, because they blamed my stepfather. And there were a lot of them to blame my stepfather thereafter. Society blamed my stepfather. You know, and you have to remember, now, this is in the late 60s, early 70s. I was only in my 20s. Women didn't become alcoholics in their early 20s then. You know, you didn't look at alcoholism. You looked at something else that happened in their childhood. They didn't become alcoholics then. You know, my mother used to say I was always a nervous child, she would say. You know, when I went to go see the psychiatrist, Mom would say to the family, well, Judy's going to see a psychiatrist. You know, her nerves are bad. And by God, between 8 and 10 in the morning, they were. They were really bad. They were awful. And I went, I got crazy one night, and I was living over on the south side of town, and I got crazy one night. I'd been out on a drunk, and I called my mother, and I was just falling apart. I was just falling apart. I hadn't eaten, and the manner in which I was living was just horrid. There was just nothing good about it. And called Mom, and the next day we went over to Georgia Mental Health Institute, and I became a patient there. And I just thought I was going to go in for a couple hours, you know, and talk to somebody, and they would give me something, and I'd be fine. And they put me on a ward that they locked at night and told me I was suicidal, homicidal. And I can remember at one stage of the game, somehow or another, I was talking to one of the shrinks there, and I remember him saying to me, Judy, we cannot let you out of here because you are of danger to yourself and to society. And I want to tell you all, I was 5 years sober before I realized what that really meant. It did not dawn on me how sick I really was until I remember him telling me that. Because I really was so volatile, and I was so filled with hate, and I was so filled with all those bad feelings that alcoholics have, you know, the guilt and the remorse and the why can't I get my act together and feeling so inferior, you know, that I really was not safe to be let out on the streets. I just wasn't safe to be let out on the streets. During my drinking career, things had gotten really, really tight money-wise, and you know, after a while, you can only threaten people with knives so long, and then they move. And so there were not a lot of people in my life to support me in my bad habit. You know, and I was running out of money, and I was running out of booze, and I had long since run out of friends. And And I called the guy I had met in the bar and restaurant business, which was the business I was in now, and I went to work for him that night as a hooker in Atlanta, because that's what I had to do. And I can remember when I was getting dressed to go on my first call, that I looked like what I had become. And I, once again, I told myself I didn't care, that it didn't matter. You know? And a lot of times when I do this at conferences, and I look around the audience and I can see the look of disdain and disgust on some people, which cracks me up into itself. Jeez, you know. I had a woman, and she did not know that it was going to be me that was telling the story, but she was sitting across from me at a table one night, and she said, you know, I have heard that there is a hooker that has moved into the area in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that she actually tells that from the podium. And y'all would have been very proud of me because I did not slap her. That's how sober I am, right? I just waited till I got up behind the podium. But I'm going to tell you that my biggest critics in AA usually fall into two categories, and that is A, the guys that had to pay for it, or B, the women who didn't have sense enough to sell it. So... And you know, ladies, I've kind of reached the stage in life where I'm almost proud. Do you know what I'm saying? I look in the mirror now and think, gee, she used to get $50 for that girl. Lord have mercy. But, you know, I think what's really it's so hypocritical about that attitude is, first of all, there isn't a soul in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not many of them in Al-Anon, that haven't prostituted themselves in one way or another to get the drink. Okay? Now, you can call it cheating on your expense account. You can call it whatever you want to call it, babe. But because of alcohol, because of your addiction, you did something that you knew was truly against your moral fiber. Don't stand there and look down at me, honey. Don't stand there and look down at me just because I had the guts to say what it was. All right? You can call it cheating. You can call it whatever you want to call it. All right? But we did what we had to do, and I firmly believe that. We did what we had to do. Okay? And I heard the same lady that told my story say, if I could have done better, I would have done better. And that is true. If I could have done better, I would have done better. You know? And I'm going to tell you, that career did not last long because you have to be even somewhat sober. I mean, if you can't stand up and you keep sliding down the lamppost, man, you just don't get much done, you know. And that's when I went into the hospital, and that's where I stayed. And then after I got out of there, I had been there, I don't know what happened, but I got mad at somebody, and they put me on some pills to keep me from hitting other patients, and I was really just kind of stupid, you know, I really was. And it's not that when they put you on Miller-Roll, you can't hit people, you can still hit people, it just takes about a week and a half to get there, that's all. And you can see it. It's like you're standing outside of yourself, and you can just see it take forever, you know. You know you're going in that direction, but it's just not getting there. But anyway, they put me on those things for a while, and it just kind of mellowed me out. But I didn't like the fact that because I had been bad, they would not let me out. And so I pulled an alcoholic con. We've all pulled alcoholic cons, but this was far and away my best, because I went ahead and I got real, real good out there at the hospital. And I went to my shrink, and I became very humble, which we alcoholics do very well, too, when we want something. And I became very humble, and I told him I knew I had been a bad patient, but for the past 3 weeks, I had really, really tried. And And I felt like I had made some progress, and I realized that my behavior was bad. Oh, it was beautiful, people. And I wondered if I could. I know I didn't deserve a full weekend pass, but if he could please just give me a 3-hour pass so I could go home and get my winter clothes. And he said, yeah, it was bad. And of course, he was very pleased with the progress that I'd made. And so he said, sure. He said, you can go home and get your winter clothes. 3-hour pass is all we'll give you this time. And that was in November of 72, and I'm still out on that 3-hour pass. You don't tell an alcoholic, no, you can't. You know, because we'll say, yes, we can, you know. Might take me 3 weeks, I'm getting out of here. And I went on, which hopefully, please dear God, is my last drunk. And I don't know, I had a guy waiting for me, and we took off. We had a couple bottles of bourbon and 2 cases of Miller High Life beer, and I woke up in some flea bag hotel on the south side of Atlanta. And obviously, my mother and I have tried to piece this whole scenario together. We're not real sure, but it was 10 to 14 days I was in that mess. And I obviously had not let anybody in the room to clean or anything else. And I still had the same clothes on that I had when I left the Institute. And to the best of my knowledge, I hadn't bathed. 10 to 14 days without a change of clothes or a bath or probably nothing decent to eat either. And that, to me, is what I remember about my alcoholism, you know, that because that's what my alcoholism was. My alcoholism was dirty, and it was nasty, and it was distasteful, and it was sick, and it was all those things that society wants no part of is what my alcoholism was. And some kind soul got me back to my mother's house, and my mother was to come home that day and find her 23-year-old daughter in that condition, you know, having not bathed and passed out on her sofa one more time. Shortly thereafter, a few days thereafter, I attempted suicide, and Mother rushed me to the hospital, and we got back home, and it just didn't really matter, you know. I had reached the point that our big book tells us about, you know, where I couldn't see life with, and I couldn't see life without alcohol. I was at the jumping off place. I couldn't see it. I knew I couldn't keep the drinking up. I couldn't keep the living like I was living, and I knew that. I just knew that. I knew I was losing my mind. I knew that. There was no doubt in my mind. My mind was going. You know, I knew that. And I just could not handle it anymore. But I could not envision a life without drinking. I simply could not envision how am I going to cope. You see, because I didn't cope well with life at all. I came up in the 60s, and I didn't like a lot of stuff that was going on in the 60s. The 60s were, although they were kind of a weird time, the clothes were enough to keep you drunk on themselves, but it was a bad time, it was a good time in our society, you know, and I always felt like I was so responsible for so much of what went on then. You know, and it, for those of you who weren't around, we had a lot going on in our country. We had the Vietnam War going on, and that war, I did not like that war, but I did not like the way the guys were being treated that came home either, you know, and that was painful to me. And we had a lot of race riots going on in our country, and you'd turn the TV on, and you'd see people being blasted with fire hoses and dogs, and it was just horrid. It was just horrid. You know, and the only way I could cope with that was to drink. That was the only way I could cope. And so I knew I wasn't going to do any better, you know, 6 years later, 7 years later, at coping. And I could not envision life without drinking. I just couldn't. Well, my mother was very kind to me, and 3 days after my attempt at suicide, she threw me out of her home. And never, ever will I forget the look on her face, nor the words she said. You know, you have to get out. You pack your bags, and you get out. Your behavior will no longer be tolerated. You get the hell out. And she was standing at the back door of our home. And I remember the tears were coming down her cheek. I was so angry with her. I was so angry with her. How could she do this? I am her firstborn. How could she possibly do this to me? You know, throwing me out of her house. And not knowing how much love that really took. How difficult that was for her to throw her daughter out of her home. She was 100% right. I was 23 years old. I was a mess. I was not getting any better. I wasn't trying to get any better. No. I went to stay with my cousin Joanne. That lasted 3 weeks. Jo was going to fix me. She'd read a lot about alcoholism. And she knew if she just talked to me the right way and said the right things that I would quit drinking. She knew that. And after about 3 weeks, she came to me just as frustrated as anyone could get and said, "You've got to go. I've never seen anybody drink like you." And I had no place to go, people. I had no place to go. That was it. I had no place to go. She was the last of anybody to take me in for even a night. No. And I remember looking at her and saying, "Well, call AA, Joe." Now, the only thing I had ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, aside from once in a while it was mentioned there on the unit, but I remember an ad we had, and maybe some of y'all remember too, it was just an On the Rocks glass, and then they were pouring liquor in it, and it said, "If you think you have a problem with alcohol," and then there was a long pause, it said, "You probably do." And I call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remembered that, and that's the reason why she called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she called for me, and I went to my very first AA meeting. And that was December the 18th, 1972. And I remember thinking, you know, I remember one lady said to me, "You know, my God, you really must want to get sober because you're stopping a week before Christmas." Well, hell, I didn't know it was a week before Christmas. You know, you just lose track of all that. You just don't, you know, I mean, I noticed there were a lot of different colored lights on, but hey, you know, I had lights going on in the dark all the time. And snakes and whatever else wanted to move in. I went to my first AA meeting. I got to tell you about the 12-step call. The guy that came in first was one of the best-looking men I had ever seen, and I knew I should have joined AA a long time before that. But he was very kind, very good-looking man, and little gray at the temples, beautiful, beautiful tan. His name was Buddy. Buddy's gone now. And right behind him comes this sweet, little, cute, petite, darling little lady. And she had on a brown princess coat, I'll never forget this, had brown velvet collar. She had little pearl earrings. You know. Not a hair was out of place on this gal. Not a hair was out of place. She had these tiny little heels. She reaches out. She's got white gloves on.
White gloves.
Reaches out to shake my hand and says, "Hi, my name's Bunny." And I, oh, God. That's the last place I wanted to be was with Bunny, I can tell you. Because you got to understand, at that point in time in my life, I had a cigarette. It always stayed in my mouth, in the corner of my mouth. I talked with it in there. You know, I would carry on a conversation with you. It would just kind of flop. Ashes would go all over the place. Never slowed me down, man. You know. At that point in time, I had on those black vinyl, God, you remember those vinyl boots we used to wear, right? And heels like this. The hair was hanging over the eye. I had those big hoop earrings on. And here comes this sweet little petite bunny. And I thought, man, ain't no way I'm going anyplace with this chick. They're just not going. But I looked at my cousin Joanne, and I knew if I did not go to that meeting that night, there would be no bed for me. You know, I would be out in the cold. I knew that. I had done it. So I went to that meeting, and it was a wonderful meeting, and it was like what most newcomers remember about their first meeting, and that is the laughter. The laughter, which is absolutely the soul music of Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely. And that's what I remember, and I remember them poking fun at one another, and I remember that there seemed to be a genuine bond between these people. There just seemed to be that, you know. And they asked me at the end of the meeting, Buddy was sitting across from me at the table, and he asked me, he said, "Judy, do you have any questions? Is there anything you'd like to know about us?" And I said, "No, I don't have any questions. I am just sick to death of being drunk. Sick to death of being drunk." And to this very day, when I say those words, I am still sick to death of being drunk. I do not ever, ever want to go back to that kind of lifestyle again. I could not survive that insanity. You see, it was not the fear of dying that kept me sober those first years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those first years in Alcoholics Anonymous, dying may have been a welcome relief. Truly, it was the fear of living, of going back out there and having to live that crap day in and day out. Where am I going to get the booze? Who am I going to steal from? Who am I going to lie to? Where am I going to crash, man? I got no place to live. That's what kept me sober. That's what kept me here. Death was not a threat to me. Living was a big threat. Well, I went to that group. Now, that group was over in Sandy Springs, North Springs area. I was no longer Sandy Springs, North Springs material. I went to Sandy Springs High School and that kind of thing, but, you know, I noticed right off that those girls, those ladies that attended that meeting were not wearing leather, and I was. And very kindly, after I'd been to that meeting just a few times, a lady, very nice, and she meant this well, she really did, came up to me and suggested that I go to another group. I really was not fitting in with that group, and I, even in my early sobriety, I knew I was different. I knew my mouth was different. The way I talked, the way I acted, the way I walked was different. I was not like these ladies. And they were talking about drinking sherry in their kitchen. I had never drunk sherry. You know, I didn't. I mean, moonshine, yeah, but no sherry. You know. So I had already started to feel different, and so it was a loving thing that she did when she told me to go to Biscayne. And I went to the Biscayne. I was 11 days sober when I got to the Biscayne. You know, and that's where I got sober. And I was there just a short time, just a few days, and two men decided they were going to be my sponsors. I never asked them, they just decided. And one of them was Big Jim, another one was Dad, Leon D. And those two guys took me under their wing, and they became my sponsors. And they became my sponsors through threats. They intimidated me. Big Jim was probably the only man I was ever afraid of. I just was not afraid of him. But Big Jim had a way about saying things. I used to accuse him of going to school. They had a school somewhere. Because he could look at you and say no, and you never questioned it, man. You just, okay, you know. I can remember I came into the room one time, and I wasn't but about 3 months sober, and I was ticked off at a woman that was hanging around there. And I came barging in that room, and Dad saw me come in, and he said, "Judy, what's your problem?" So I walked over, and I said, "You see that back there?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm going to take her outside, man. I've had it with her mouth, you know. It's all the time. And I'm fed up with it. I don't want to listen to it anymore. We're going to take it outside. We're going to get this settled right now." Dad said, "Get you a cup of coffee and sit down." And I intuitively knew this was not open for discussion. I just knew this was not... And I got a cup of coffee, and I sat down, and he had a way, he was a little man, just a little bantamweight, but he had a way of really getting your attention, you know. And he took that little finger, and he was poking it right here. And he said to me, he said, "Judy, you have got to quit hitting people." That sentence unto itself just cracks me up, you know. "Hitting people," he said to me, "is not socially acceptable behavior." And then he said a line to me that I've carried with me throughout my sobriety. He said, "Judy, you can't live like a drunk and expect sobriety." Oh. And it didn't dawn on me I'd been living like a drunk. I was still dressing like a drunk. I was still talking like a drunk. I was still acting like a drunk. And I was expecting sobriety. And I was not one of those folks who came into Alcoholics Anonymous and all of a sudden became spiritual, you know, and quit cussing and started wearing the right clothes. It didn't happen that way for me. You know, I was not one of those folks who walked through the doors of AA and just became blissfully happy. You know, and as a matter of fact, if you want to know the truth, those kind of people still get on my nerves. You know, they just... Sobriety was difficult for me. Not drinking was difficult for me. You know, the best I could hope for the first year is just don't drink and keep breathing. That's all. It wasn't a matter of me looking at the steps. I had no idea what was going on with those steps. I couldn't read the big book. You know, I'd read a sentence, I'd forget it 2 seconds after I read it. I couldn't comprehend. The thing for me was just don't drink, Judy. Just don't drink, you know, and go to meetings. Well, somehow, the way y'all told me, I thought it was a rule. I thought it was something I had to do or you were going to kick me out. You know, so for the first 90 days, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days because they told me that's what I was supposed to do, and I figured it was one of your rules. And so it was about probably around 78, 79 days, I got real sick, and I got the flu, the real flu, for the first time in my life. I'd never had the real flu before. And you can get sick with that stuff, man. And I missed a meeting. I was so afraid that if somebody found out, they were going to throw me out. You know? So I went to 3 meetings the following Sunday. So just in case they said something, I could say, "Yeah, but I went to 3 meetings the following Sunday," because I didn't want y'all to throw me out. Somehow I knew that my saving grace was Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that. And I had to cling to you all so desperately. You know? I couldn't let you know I was that afraid, but I had to hold on to you so desperately. because you were the last chance I had, people. You were it. That I knew. That I knew. You know. I'm about 4 months sober, and I decide I need to get married. Praise God, that's the last thing I needed to do. Yeah, it's not hard to find a husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just one of, it's really not, you know, because there's a bunch of sickos looking for a wife, so, you know. And so I, yeah, 4 months sobriety, I get married, and my spouse had 5 months. And we were just kind of the source of entertainment for a couple of years for that group, really. We moved up to Hiawassee, Georgia, Ronnie and I did, and that was an experience because, as I told you, a lot of things didn't change for me in sobriety, and so I went up, moved up to Church of God country at that time in the 70s. That was strong Church of God country, and I was still talking that street trash and still wearing those clothes that I wore when I was working Peachtree, and let's just say I didn't fit in, okay? That just it was terrible. The meetings up there were very few and far apart. It wasn't like we have here in the city, you know, where you can go around the corner and go to a meeting. And we were broke. We were broke. It was difficult. Ronnie shot a deer that winter, and I'm glad he did, because had he not, we would not have had meat on the table. It was that kind of broke, and we were in the financial situation where you really had to look at, do I spend $2 for gas to go to a meeting, or do I spend $2 on groceries? And it's those kind of decisions and that kind of desperation. And what I held on to during that period of time was the AA literature, and I came to believe because I really did want to believe, you know. I had a desire to believe, and I had a desire to believe because my sponsors told me I had to. My sponsor told me that there will come a time in my life when the only means of defense I'm going to have against a drink is going to have to come from a higher power. And I didn't question him. I believed him, you know, and that is true. Because there were times in my sobriety when I didn't care what AA said. I didn't care what any of you said. You know, it didn't matter because I didn't like you today anyhow. You know, I didn't want to hear anything people in Alcoholics Anonymous had to say. There were days when I would get so sick and so wrapped up in myself, I didn't want to see you, I didn't want to go to a meeting, and I sure didn't want to hear one of these spiritual giants come up and say, well, just read your big book and go to meetings. Well, stuff your big book, man. You know, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear it. You know, and those were the times when I had to go to God. You know, so if you're thinking that, you know, you're not going to get a relationship with God and you can make this program without it, it has been my experience of those with that attitude, don't make it. Don't make it. Okay? You need a relationship with God. Be it ever so small, get started. Get started. Now, and that's where, I read that book, and I'd get to meetings when I could. And what happened there, of course, the marriage did not work out, and we had a terrible fight one day, and I remember walking down to this sweet little 8-acre lake that was close to the house, and I remember sitting there with my two dogs, and I was looking out over that lake, and behind that lake was a big, beautiful mountain, and I remember looking up there, and for the first time in my sobriety and for the first time in many years in my life, I said a prayer, and it was a simple prayer, and it simply was, God, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me, but I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. No. Now, I'm going to tell you, people, nobody came down and said anything to me. Nobody, the clouds didn't part, nothing. What happened was the air became still and warm and quiet. And it was as though a good friend sat down next to me and put his arm around me and said, you're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay. Now, there was no wisdom there that came. There was no clairvoyance of thought that came. What came was a peace, just a peace. And for the first time in my life, I knew I was a child of God. I was a child of God. And up until that point in my life, I had never known that. I had never known that. And when I got up and walked away from that lakeside, I felt different. It was different. The marriage lasted a total of 2 years, and I came back to Atlanta, and I got very involved in alcohol. I got involved with working with women. You know, I got involved with listening to people, not just talking, but listening to what people had to say. I can remember I went through a period in my sobriety, you know, where I felt like I was so... My drinking career was worse than any other woman's, you know, and if all she did was drink sherry in her kitchen, what does she know about suffering? I had such an attitude. You know, I really had an attitude. And then I went to a meeting one night, and I was listening to a lady, and it was a woman's meeting, and she was sobbing, and she was crying, and she was talking about some of the things that she had done during her drinking, and she shared with us about how she had gotten drunk one time and passed out in the hallway naked, and her teenage boy came home with his friends. And she said, "How do I make amends to my son for that?" And my heart broke for her, people. My heart just absolutely broke for her. Because I had, you know, I had been so selfish and so self-centered, I never thought about what they went through. It was always what I went through. And I began to care. I began to care. And I will tell you, if there is any miracle to me that stands out in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that it brings in an individual like me who did not care, who did not care about you or herself. And somewhere along the line, we learned to love. Somewhere along the line, we learned to really care. No, that's a miracle. That is a miracle. Because it wasn't going to happen to me. I was tough. I was hard. You weren't going to thaw me out, man. No way. You know, now I cry. You know, I'm a TV commercial crier. It just, you know. Yeah. My husband Craig and I, we got married in 76. We had such a wonderful life. We had an AA life together, my Craig and I did. And we started doing those things that I see other people do in life, you know, normal people. You know, like buying a house and those kind of things. It was wonderful. And I got my act together and started working on a regular basis and started, you know, not blowing up and losing jobs and losing my temper and that kind of thing. And that was cool. And I started off with one company. I'd been working as a temporary for a couple of years, and I got an assignment at this one company, and they liked me, and I liked them, and I started working my way up in there, and pretty soon they hired me full time, and that was cool, you know, and I got to do the payroll and cut checks, and I was just amazed at my own honesty, man. I'm telling you, you know, and that was wonderful. And before too long, I got another promotion, and I switched over into sales, and then I started wearing suits, and I started carrying a briefcase. And I tell you all this because one of my accounts was the Federal Reserve Bank in downtown Atlanta. And that's funny unto itself, isn't it? Because you have to have clearance to go into some of their data processing centers, and I had it. That's another one for the government there, boy. But what was neat about that is that some of you may remember, I understand it's not there now, but right across the street from Marietta Street and down the corner was Lucky Street. Well, Lucky Street used to be one of my territories. And I can remember getting out of that parking garage that was right there on the corner, and I had on my three-piece suit, and I'm carrying my leather briefcase, and I'm walking into the Federal Reserve Bank. It was the biggest account I had. You know, and I remember seeing my own reflection. And that, the glass doors of that Federal Reserve Bank, going in there, calling those guys on, you know, in their ivory tower and sell them something that, you know, I pulled it off, people, but I don't know how. But anyhow, I can remember seeing my reflection in there, and I looked like a decent human being, you know, and I was clean, and I was wearing high heels, and I looked like a lady. And I had to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because I knew where that came from. I knew where all that came from. You see, you all taught me my social skills. You taught me how to behave again. You taught me how to live again. You taught me how to act in public again. And because of what you taught me, you know, I was able to walk in there and present myself decently and with some dignity because of what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. Craig and I were doing very well, and then Craig got sick. He had some real, real serious back problems, we had just financial problems, and I don't know if any of you have had them. And, you know, a lot of times I go and you hear speakers talk, and they say, "Well, I've had problems since I've been sober." Well, I want to know, what kind of problems did you have, you know? Because I want to know, if I have that kind of problem, who can I go talk to, you know? And Craig and I really had some difficult things. We had things going well for us. I mean, we had the two cars. We had the nice house. We were going on trips. We were enjoying life and all those good things. And all of a sudden, he gets sick. And then, bingo, you know, he comes home from the doctor one day, and the doctor says, you're not going to be able to work for a year, at least a year, maybe a year and a half. You know, and then I went through some job changes and some downsizings, and what ended up happening is we went from making about $100,000 a year to $20,000 inside of 8 months. And when you drop that fast, that hard, there is no recouping, people. It doesn't matter how much you've got in savings. It doesn't matter what all you can cash in. There reaches a point where there is no way out, you know. And Craig, per our attorney's advice, Craig bankrupted, and it was just a mess. It was just a mess because, you know, not only did we have the stress of him being so very sick and in so much pain all the time, but then we had the hassles of all these collectors calling and people, and, you know, us trying to say, look, when his disability comes through, you'll get paid. Well, that's not good enough for them, you know. So it's terrible. And so we would go and we would share with our friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had another friend who was going through the same thing, and you know, we held on to one another. And we started getting back together where we met at each other's houses because we couldn't afford to go out and eat anymore. You know, so you start brewing coffee at home. It's more fun anyway. You can take your shoes off. And when you go through those things and you survive, you survive. We made a decision shortly after he was finished with the surgery and everything that we needed to move. My Craig drank several times when we were married. And I'm going to tell you, I am a marvelous alcoholic. I'm a lousy Al-Anon. I am not a good Al-Anon. I don't even profess to be a good Al-Anon. I went to Al-Anon meetings, and I'm going to tell you, I thank those ladies from the bottom of my heart, because they were kind and caring and giving to me. They shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, and they got me through it. They really helped me through it. You know, I went to Al-Anon meetings, and I'm so glad one lady said, Judy, don't make any decisions now, because you know how we are. Okay, this is it. I've had it. Where's the? I want to talk to the attorney right now. I'm done. You know. And she kept saying, Judy, don't make any decisions today, and I'm so grateful to her that she did. You know, because the marriage survived. And when he came, decided to get sober again, and I'll never forget, he called and asked if we could come get him. I said, I'm busy right now. When I get finished with what I'm doing, we'll come get you. And we eventually did. And he was sick, and I was all set. You know how you rehearse these speeches you're going to give people? So I would go to work that day, and I rehearsed this speech I'm going to give him about what he has done to us with his drinking, and I rehearsed the speech all day in my mind, and I'm all set to let him have it. Now he's been sober 72 hours, he can handle this now. Now. So I'm all set to go home and really let him have it, and I walk in and I look on that sofa, and there he is, and he's shaking, and he is sweating, and he is so sick. And I went back in my mind, and I felt every shake and every sweat and every sick he was feeling. I felt it all. And I thought, man, you can't come down on him now. Not now. He had asked me, he said, well, what are you going to do, Jude? And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, Craig. I really don't know. I said, right now I'm so damn mad at you, I just don't know. I said, I've already called an attorney. She's already started, well, who gets the bedroom furniture? I don't want to go there, man. I just don't even want to go there. You know, and I said, we'll just do this thing one day at a time. And we did. Shortly thereafter, we moved up to Ohio, and that was an adventure, and I'm grateful. I am grateful that we moved to Ohio. It was wonderful. There was a lot of changes that we had to do. We bought an old farmhouse, a big old farmhouse, two-story farmhouse, bought it at auction. The house was 125 years old, not a level floor in the place. I used to love to bring my kittens in there to play, because you'd throw a ball, man, and it just went everywhere. I mean, it just... They'd go nuts, you know, no matter where he pitched it, it came right back to him. And I went to change a light bulb one time, and the wiring broke in my hand. It gives you a real sense of security. But it's a wonderful adventure, and we tore that place apart and redid it on the inside. And I'm going to tell you something, if your marriage survives a refurbishing of a home, you have a good marriage. The kitchen was just about the end of us, people, I'm going to tell you. But we had fun. And then a couple years ago, Craig started having a lot of problems. He had a multitude of problems to begin with, but when the diabetes set in and then the arthritis set in, things just got worse. And he started to get to the point where there'd be days when he just simply could not get out of the bed. Then the arthritis was building more and more on his spine. He had broken his back playing football, And it was causing a lot of problems with the nerves. And what ended up happening is the nerve that controls the diaphragm or the breathing was becoming paralyzed. And he was having a harder and harder time breathing. And May of last year, well, Terry came up in February, and I told Terry then that Craig was not doing well, and things were getting worse, and he was on 18 medications, and it just wasn't getting any better, and he had reached the stage in his illness, you know, where if they give him a pill for this, it's going to counteract with the one they give him for this, and it was sad. And he hurt all the time. He hurt all the time. And, you know, there's parts in a marriage and in a relationship that you just keep growing, you know, and a good relationship just keeps growing. And it wasn't that the passion was gone. It was just that it couldn't be anymore. But the love grew. The love kept growing, you know, because you reach a new level when you have someone with a serious illness that you love in your life. The depth of caring for one another goes beyond anything I ever thought I was capable of. You know, and in May I took him to the hospital on Sunday morning at 4 o'clock. We took him by the ambulance, and Tuesday morning I talked to the doctor, and he said he's not coming home this time, Jude. And I did what you all taught me to do. I got on the phone and I called my people in AA, and I said, my hubby's not coming home. Will you come stay with me? And in 5 minutes, it was one guy, and 10 minutes later, two other people showed, and I got on the phone, and I don't remember a whole lot after that. And Terry came up on Thursday, and we sat there with Craig. Terry was with me the whole time. He sat with me in ICU, And I have to tell you about this little community that we had moved into, because you see, we had become members of a church there, which was a real kick for me, man. And I love that little church, and I had become part of a community. I'm one of those, I believe that the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous and what our founders really wanted us to do, and it says so in the book, is to fit back into society. That's what they wanted us to do. And it's real important to me that I not only fit in and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's real important to me that I become a member of my community, that I contribute to my community as well, that I do those things that good citizens do, that I vote, that I keep my yard nice, that I do those things that good citizens do, you see. I want it all. I want to be a part of what's out there, and I want to be a part of what's in here, and I can do that. I've learned that here. When they found out that Craig was not coming home, people from the church came to the hospital, and they sat with me. When I went up to see Craig on Sunday, the doctor came up and he said, "Judy, your husband's temperature went up to 105 last night. We had to pack him in ice." And he said, "You're going to have to make the decision today or next week, but you've got to do it," because he was on a respirator. And he said, "I wish I could tell you that we'd be able to get him home." He said, "Even if we were to be able to get him home this time, he'll be back here next week. He's not going to get any better." And at 2:30, I signed the paper. And hardest thing you ever have to do, people, I'm going to tell you, there is just no easy way to do that. There just isn't. Because they make it real clear to you, and he read it to me because I could not read. The nurse read it to me and said, "You are aware that by doing this, the patient will probably die. And you got to sign that, you know." And I'm telling you, God signed that piece of paper. It wasn't me. I didn't have the strength to do it. And my Craig went to God at 4:30 that afternoon. And I was there holding his hand. And Terry was there with me. You know, and I have no anger towards anybody or towards anything. You know, a lot of people would come up to me after Craig died and say, "It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be angry." And I wasn't angry. I wasn't angry at God. I saw what he did that last year and a half. Nobody should have to live that way. Nobody. No, I saw that. I wasn't angry at God. I wasn't angry at Craig. My God, we had 24 years. I was with one man. Isn't that incredible? Just incredible. You know, and I'll tell you something. He was my soulmate. That man was my soulmate. Always will be. You know, if I don't ever have a relationship again, that is fine, honey, because I had the best one for me. God gave me the best man I could have had. And I believe that with all my heart. I believe that with all my heart. All my life I had wanted a wonderful marriage, and I had one. And I am totally satisfied there. Totally satisfied. And people would come up to me and they'd say, it's okay to be angry with God. It's okay to be angry with Craig. And I wasn't angry with anybody except the people who kept coming up and saying, it's okay to be angry. You know? You know, and I still grieve. I mean, the move here was difficult because I had to pick up, I had to get rid of things that were his that I didn't want to get rid of, you know. And I don't know why. You just go through these things when you're grieving, you know. You hold on to things. Maybe like somewhere in your mind you think they'll come back to life, even though you know they won't. You feel that way, you know. And in doing that, I went through our pictures that we had of all our AA families. And you know, it was beautiful. And every one of those pictures, my husband and I were smiling. And every one of them, we were laughing, you know. We were holding on to one another. I was a lucky lady. I was a lucky lady. I had a funeral, and a lot of my friends from Atlanta came. Mary Ellen was there, and Carrie was there, and Joyce was there, and Alex, and, oh, God, I hope I didn't forget anybody. But, and we had, the place was packed, and I can remember I was sitting at the front of the funeral home, and I noticed they were carrying chairs. Well, there was another funeral going on, so I just thought it was, and I turned around, and it was standing room only in this place. You know, it was AA members from the friends we made in Ohio, AA members from Atlanta, members of our church, members of our community. The place was packed. And people got up and talked about what my husband had done for them. And then we sang hymns. I knew Craig's favorite hymns, and we sang hymns. And the guy that sang the lead, and then we all sang in on the chorus. And I'm telling you, people, it was a choir of angels. You never heard anything sound so beautiful in your life. That we gave him a terrific send-off, didn't we, baby? You bet we did. By God, they knew Craig Pierce was coming when we were finished. Yeah. Yeah. But I miss him every day. You know I do. Every day. You know. But I was lucky. I was lucky. There's a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous that are changing. Oh, shoot. A lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous that are changing. And I know, you know, we have to change, don't we? We've got to. I mean, we're part of society. Society changes. We have to change. But our 12 steps don't have to change. And our basics don't have to change. And, you know, I rarely, rarely, rarely ever talk in Alcoholics Anonymous where I don't get on a soapbox about something. You know, and I don't want to shortchange y'all either, you know? I got a thing, and it's just my thing. And if you agree with it, I'm really glad. But I got a... The last word in the Lord's Prayer is amen. Thank you. It is not keep coming back. It works if you work it, but you got to work it every day and every night, or you're going to get... That is not the last... Now, that may not bother you, but it annoys the hell out of me. You know, every time I hear that, I go back in my mind to when I was 5 years old and the Mickey Mouse clock was on. You remember? I'm waiting for the black ears to show up here just any minute now. People, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. For the love of God, let the last word in the Lord's Prayer be amen, and the meeting is over. We never did this sing-song stuff years ago. We never did it. You know, I mean, we're adults here, for crying out loud. Knock it off. And I'll tell you too, really, and this may be silly on my part, and I really don't care. I really think it's disrespectful to the Lord's Prayer. I really do. There was something beautiful about those final seconds when you said amen. There was just that stillness, just for a couple seconds, that was like you could take a deep breath and you knew your day was better. You know, you knew your day was better. But I mean, some of this just goes on and on. And I'll tell you, in some meetings, I'll just let go of your hand and walk off. I don't want to hear it no more. So, you know, do what you want to. But if you agree with me, take it back to your home group and just tell them the Lord's Prayer ends with amen. Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit to some of the folks here who may only have like 2, 3, 4 years sobriety. And if you're sitting out there and you're thinking this thing is not going to work, and you know you're not making it in AA and you're probably going to flunk AA too, and you might as well just take your own life, you're okay, baby. Let me tell you, you are okay. I sat out there when I was 2, 3, 4 years sober, and I thought, man, I'm not going to do this thing. You know, I'd see these 90-day wonders come in, man. They got a brand new car. They got a brand new job. They're making $87,000 a year. Nobody is angry at them. Their family has just welcomed them back in. I'm sitting there with 4 years sobriety. I can barely talk to my mother. I'm thinking, what's going on here? You know, here I go. I'm flunking AA. You know, there is no. I just didn't think I was making it. I just didn't think I was making it. But you know what? Suicide was an option. Suicide was an option. Drinking wasn't. Drinking wasn't. There's a miracle there. For the alcoholic, there's a miracle there. Because I had been with you long enough to know drinking wasn't going to solve it. In all my sickness, I learned something. Now, I am not by any means suggesting to you that that is healthy thinking. Okay? But what I am saying is give yourself some credit, baby. You are doing better despite yourself. You know, then get with the sponsor and get that garbage out, because that's what's getting you to the point where you want to kill yourself. You need to sit down and tell it all. Now, and we all seem to think we are so unique, you know, we are so unique. I was absolutely convinced after about 6 years, because I was 6.5 years sober before I heard my story, that I was the only hooker that ever got sober. Now, I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous a long time now, and I've been doing this for a long time too, and I can tell you I am not the only one. There's a lot of us in here. A lot of us in here. And I also understand, too, for the ladies who may be in this situation, I also understand, too, that one young lady came up to me and she said, Judy, I've got kids. You know, and she said, as much as I'd love to be honest about that, I have to be careful. I said, of course you do. Of course you do. You have to take, we don't cleanse ourselves at the expense of somebody else. Okay? We have to be, use some tact and some discretion as to what we do and how we do it. You know, but that doesn't mean that when you're sitting down talking to a girl that you know has been where you've been, that you can't tell her. You don't have to tell it from the podium. And trust me, this is not my fifth step I'm taking up here, okay? We don't even want to go there. But no, but you can do that. You can do that. You can share on a one-to-one, and you can help somebody else, you know. I also know, too, that what my sponsors did for me, more than just teach me Alcoholics Anonymous, or the big book, they taught me by the way they lived. All right? The people I looked up to in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked up to them, not because of what they said in the meeting, because, you know, we don't have to be around here long, man, and we can sound good. All right? We know the key words. We know the things to say that makes everybody go, ooh. You know, we know that. You know. We know those. I wanted to see how you walked, man. I wanted to see how you lived. I wanted to see how you talked to your wife when there was nobody around listening. I wanted to see how you took care of your kids when there was nobody around to watch you. You know, I wanted to see how far did you take this program? Did you just do it while you were in the AA room for 2 hours? Or did you really take it outside? Did you really take it outside? You know, because that's where the beauty of this program is. If you're only living AA 2 hours a day, man, you're shortchanging yourself. You know, you are shortchanging yourself. Yeah, unbelievable. Because you see, I have found out that what we have here is truly a gift from God. It is really a gift from God. And I've also found out that we can share that with people out there. We can share it with the girl who checks us out at the grocery store. You know, some people are just jerks and they always blame them. You know, that's not necessary. Sometimes those girls need a smile, they need a laugh, they need a kind word. Same thing with the waitress. Now, I used to be a waitress, so I'm a little partial there. But you know, a waitress isn't out there, man, for you to dump your bad mood on. You know, she's working for a living. It's the hardest work I ever did in my life. Do something, make the girl smile. There's no need to be taking out your bad mood on her. You know, and we don't learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't do that here. You know, we need to share what we've... When I became a member of that little church that there in Ohio, that little Delroy Community Church, It was nice to know that I was a member of that church. I participated in that church. I did things. You know, I'll never forget, they passed a little sheet around, wanted people to bake cookies for a vacation Bible school. And I signed up. And I thought to myself, a group in Atlanta is not going to believe this, man. But, you know, I mean, I don't have kids, but what the heck? I mean, I make a raisin cookie that is just good, folks. It's just good. So I made that, and that was great, and I was glad to be a part of. And nobody had to see me sign up. Nobody had to see me do that. I was just glad that I could do it, that I could be part of that community, you know, that I could fit in. I liked the fact that when I went to the corner market and my neighbors saw me, they smiled, you know. When I left Ohio and I told the folks in my community I was leaving Ohio, the girls from the bank took me to lunch, you know. The girl from the hardware store started crying when I told her my move date. These were just people that were just in my daily lives, you know. It was incredible. The people that I had worked with at two firms, at two brokerages up there, they took me to lunch, bought me little presents. It was so nice. It was just so nice. I had never been apart. My AA group, you know, gave me a going-away party. People didn't do that for me. People didn't do that for me. You know, nobody wanted a part of me when I got to y'all. I'm going to share with you two things that really warmed my heart before I close. I don't know how long I'd been sober, probably 10 or 12 years, somewhere around there. And somebody asked me, if something were to happen to them, would I take their children? Now, what you have to understand is during my drinking career, I was in a car with a guy and we pulled up at his sister's house and she came running out of that house like Satan himself was chasing her and came to my side of the car and said, don't you get out of that car. I don't want my kids to see a woman like you. You stay in that car. Oh, hey, I didn't want to see your kids anyway, you know. But I reached under and I took my fix for that. You know exactly what I did. I reached under that seat as soon as she walked away and got out that bottle and took a drag off that bottle so I could stand with the woman had just told me, so I could cope with what I had just been told. That's the only way I could do it. And so for someone to come up to me 12 years later, or however long it was, and say to me, would you take my children, was just more than I thought I could cope with. I have never been so flattered in my life. Never. Mother, you know, mending fences with family is difficult. You know, and there's a stage that we go through, I think, in sobriety and just in life in general, where, you know, we got to blame them, right? It's all their fault. Somehow it's, and then, of course, there's another thing going around, too, that just absolutely cracks me up. If the family doesn't get into the program, then you're not going to stay sober. Let me tell you something. If I waited on my family to get here, I'd still be drunk. My mother has never been to an Al-Anon meeting, has no intentions of ever going to an Al-Anon meeting, and that's okay. You know, now there used to be a time when I criticized her for that and thought that she didn't care. Why should she? You know, there is no need for that. There really is no need for that. So we had to, taking time to mend fences, and that came through practicing the program. That came through learning to be patient and tolerant. That came through forgiving, you know. And even my stepfather, on most days, I have forgiven, you know, because I realize now that in his alcoholism, he was a very, very sick man, you know. And on my good days and when I'm right, I feel no anger towards him. I would love to tell you it's totally gone. It's not. It's not. Because if I need something to pick up on, I'll pick up on that one, man, you know. But I'm much, so, so much better with it, and I do feel a degree of compassion for him. Because he did have some wonderful qualities. He really had some wonderful qualities. He was just a very, very sick man. Just very sick. Mom and I were out shopping one day. That's when I was still living in Atlanta. And the car was quiet. We had been out and had breakfast, and we were on our way to one of the malls. I don't know where it was, and driving around the perimeter, and she reached over and she patted me on the shoulder. And she said, you're a good daughter, Judy. And you're a good person. And Mama loves you very much. And that to me is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, as I, you know, I have so many of my friends here and really my family. You know, you all are my family. And what you have to remember, too, is back in the days when I came in, there were a lot of us that just came in off the street. We didn't have families, man. Our families didn't want nothing to do with us, you know. So our families were one another. We relied on one another because that's all we had. That, and we did everything together. Everything together. We did laundry together. You know, we went out to eat together. We went to meetings together. In some cases, we slept together. You know how that... That was before we were well, huh, Hal?
Yeah.
Right. But it is wonderful, and I will tell you, the folks in Alcoholics Anonymous, since Craig passed away, Mary Ellen in particular, has called me at least twice a week to make sure I was okay. Now I don't know what she thought was going to happen, but nevertheless, I'm very grateful that she called. And one time she didn't believe me, so she came up to see me, just to make sure I wasn't lying. Now, it has been a big adjustment. I came to you with a total inability to care and to love and to laugh. I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And you know, when I look at myself today and I look at what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't help but be grateful. I always introduce myself as a grateful alcoholic. You see, because I know what I brought to you. I know what I was like on the inside. I know the bitterness and the coldness and the hatred that I felt towards just life in general. You know? And now I like looking at myself because I know that I am very, very capable of loving. I love real easy. It doesn't take much for me to love people anymore. You know, and I'm trusting, in which I wasn't, and sometimes too trusting, but that's okay. I always recover. You know, I always recover if I get hurt. That's okay. You know, I cry easily and I laugh easily. You know, and that didn't happen before I came here. You know, I know that there is a loving God that cares for me. I absolutely believe that. I absolutely believe that He reached out and He brought me to you. I believe that. You know. And that I can go to Him no matter what. No matter what. And when I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and I look around, I hope to remind myself always, what can I do for the one who is suffering? What can I do for the one who is suffering? You know, it is not always the newcomer that we need to focus in on. We can be at 10, 15, 20 years sobriety and be hurting. And be hurting to the core of our very being. And some of us will have such an ego that we would not let anybody know. You know, we will die with that pain before we will say at 20 years sobriety, I am falling apart on the inside, man. I am falling apart. No, don't do that to yourself. Don't do that to yourself. It's human. Pain is human, people. It's okay. At 10 years sobriety or at 40 years sobriety, it's okay. No, it's okay. And I will share with you, too, that if you're working with somebody or you know somebody in your group who is going through a bad time, for the love of God, offer them more than read the big book and go to meetings. You know? That is such a flippant, arrogant comment to make to someone you know who is really hurting. Take 15 minutes out of your day, sit down and say to them, what can I do to help? That's what you're supposed to do if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I would like to really come up with something profound to close here, and I can't because I truly am overcome. Because I love so many of you so very much. And it is so good to look out there and see you all again. You know. And know I'm back with my family. And know I'm back where I belong. I thank you for being here. I thank you for your support. And I thank you for your love. God bless you.